This is Audible.
Listening Library presents Woods Runner by Gary Paulson. Read for you by Danny Campbell. Author's note. I've written this book a bit differently from my other historical fiction, alternating the fiction with historical segments that I feel are essential for the reader. I did this for two reasons. One, I wanted to set Samuel's story against the larger context of the Revolutionary War. And two, I wanted readers to understand what it was really like to live on the frontier at that time, with virtually nothing, no money, no electricity, no towns, few neighbors, nothing but your own strength. Part 1. Green. The Forest. 1776. Chapter 1. He was not sure exactly when he became a child of the forest. One day, it seemed he was 11 and playing in the dirt around the cabin or helping with chores. And the next, he was 13, carrying a .40 caliber Pennsylvania flintlock rifle, wearing smoked buckskin clothing and moccasins, moving through the woods like a knife through water while he tracked deer to bring home to the cabin for meat. He sat now by a game trail, waiting for the deer he knew would come soon. He had heard it, a branch brushing a hairy side, a twig cracking. Smelled it when the wind blew toward him, the musk and urine of a buck. He checked the priming on his rifle while he waited. His mind and body relaxed, patient, ears and eyes and nose alert, quiet. Every part of him at rest, yet focused and intense. And he pictured his life, how he lived in two worlds. Sometimes Samuel thought that a line dividing those worlds went right through their cabin. To the west, beyond the small parchment window made of grease-soaked sheepskin scraped paper thin, lay the forest. The forest was unimaginably vast, impenetrable, mysterious, and dark. His father had told him that a man could walk west for a month, walk as fast as he could, and never see the sun. So high and dense was the canopy of leaves. Even close to their homestead, 12 acres clawed out of the timber with a small log cabin and a lean-to for a barn. The forest was so thick that in the summer Samuel could not see more than 10 or 15 yards into it. Some oak and elm and maple trees were 4 and 5 feet in diameter, and so tall and thickly foliaged their height could only be guessed. A wild world. And while there were trails made by game, and sometimes used by natives, settlers, or trappers, the paths wandered and meandered so that they were impossible to use in any sensible way, except to hunt. When he first started going into the forest, Samuel went only a short distance. That first time, though, he was well armed with his light Pennsylvania rifle and dry powder and a good knife. He instantly felt that he was in an alien world. As a human, he did not belong. It was a world that did not care about man any more than it cared about dirt or grass or leaves. He did not get lost that first time, because he'd marked trees with his knife as he walked so he could find his way out. But still, in some way, he felt lost, as if, were he not careful, a part of him would disappear and never return. Gone to the wildness. Samuel had heard stories of that happening to some men. They entered the forest to hunt or trap or look for new land to settle, and simply vanished. Gone to the woods, people said of them. Some, he knew, were dead, killed by accident, or panthers, or bear, or Indians. He had seen such bodies. One, a man mauled to death by a bear that had attacked his horse while the man was plowing. The man's head was eaten. Another, killed by an arrow through the throat. An arrow Samuel knew that came out of the woods from a bow that was never seen, shot by a man who was never known. And when he was small, safe inside the cabin near the mud brick fireplace with his mother and father, he had heard the panther scream. They sounded like a woman gone mad. Oh, he knew the forest could kill. Once, sitting by the fire, a distant relative, a shirt-tail uncle who was a very old man of nearly 50, named Ishmael, had looked over his shoulder as if expecting to see monsters and said, "Nothing dies of old age in the forest. Not bugs, not deer, not bear, nor panthers, nor man. Live long enough, be slow enough, get old enough, and something eats you. Everything kills." And yet Samuel loved the forest now. He knew the sounds and smells and images like he knew his own mind, his own yard. Each time he had entered, he'd gone farther, learned more, marked more trees with his knife until he always knew where he was. Now he thought of the deep forest as his home as much as their cabin. But some men vanished for other reasons, too, because the forest pulled them and the wild would not let them go. 3 years ago, when Samuel was 10, he had seen one of these men, a man who moved like smoke. His rifle, a part of his arm, a tomahawk through his belt, next to a slab-bladed knife, eyes that saw all things, ears that heard all things. One family in the settlement had a room on their cabin that was a kind of store. The man had come to the store to buy small bits of cloth and powder and English flints for his rifle, at the same time Samuel was waiting for his mother to buy thread. The man smelled of deep forest, of smoke and blood and grease and something green. Samuel knew he smelled that way, too. The stranger could not be still. As he stood waiting, he moved. Though he was courteous and nodded to people, as soon as he had the supplies for his rifle and some salt, he left. He was there one moment and gone the next, into the trees, gliding on soft moccasins to become part of the forest, as much as any tree or leaf or animal. He went west, away from man, away from the buildings and the settled land. Now Samuel heard a new sound. He moved his eyes slowly to the left without turning his head, and was rewarded by seeing a tick-infested rabbit sitting by a tree, trying to clear the insects out of his ears. Samuel smiled. Even in dead of winter, the rabbits were always trying to rid themselves of the pests. The sight made him think of his mother, who was intensely curious and had once asked him to take her into the forest. They had not gone far, not over 500 yards from the edge of the clearing, and had stopped under a towering oak where sunlight could not get through. There was a subdued green light over everything. Even their faces looked a gentle green. "I have to go back," she said, her eyes wide, wrapping a shawl tightly around her shoulders, though it was summer warm. "This is too thick. Even the air is green. So thick it feels like it could be cut. I have to go back now." Although Samuel's parents lived in the wilderness, they were not a part of it. They had been raised in towns and had been educated in schools where they'd been taught to read and write and play musical instruments. They moved west when Samuel was a baby, so that they could devote themselves to a quiet life of hard physical work and contemplation. They loved the woods, but they did not understand them. Not like Samuel. They had told their son that they didn't belong in towns, either. They weren't comfortable in the world of roads, houses, and villages. East of the imaginary line in the cabin was what his father and mother called civilization. They told Samuel about the chaos of towns that they'd escaped. There were noises, hammers clanging at blacksmith forges, chickens clucking, dogs barking, cows lowing, horses whinnying and whickering. People who always seemed to need to be talking to one another. There wasn't noise in the forest. There were smells. Wood smoke filled the air in every season, because it wasn't just for heat, but to cook as well. The smell of oak for long fires, pine for short and fast and hot fires. The smell of bread, and sometimes, if they were lucky and had honey or rock sugar to pulverize in a sack with a hammer, sweet pie. The odor of stew cooking in the cast iron pot over an outside fire, or in an iron kettle hung in the fireplace, the scent flying up through the chimney and out over the ground as the wind moved the smoke around. There was the tang of manure, stacked in the back of small shed-like barns to age before it was put on gardens. Horse and cow and chicken manure from their farm and other farms. So many smells swirled by the same wind throughout the small valley. Their valley was like a huge bowl, nestled in the hills in far western Pennsylvania. Here lived, and had always lived, Samuel Lehi Smith, age 13, with his father, Olin, and his mother, Abigail, parents who Samuel did not always understand, but whom he loved. They read to him about the world beyond from their prized books. All the long winter nights, with tallow candles burning while they sat by the fireplace, they read aloud to each other. At first, he listened as they took turns. Later, he read to himself and knew the joyous romp of words on paper. He read all the books they had in the cabin and then books from other cabins in the valley, so that he could know more and more of a world found only in his imagination and dreams. To the east lay the faraway world of enormous cities, and the Great Sea, and Europe, and ancient Rome, and darkest Africa, and the mysterious land of the Asias, and so many people that couldn't be counted. All kinds of different people with foreign languages and their knowledge of strange worlds. To the east lay polished shoes and ornate clothes, and formal manners and enormous wealth. His mother would spin tales for him about cultured men who wore carefully powdered wigs and dipped snuff out of their little silver snuff boxes, and beautiful women dressed in gowns of silk and satin with swirling petticoats as they danced in the great houses and exclusive salons of London and Paris. Now, the deer stepped out. It stood in complete profile, not 30 yards away. Samuel held his breath. He waited for it to turn away, look around in caution. When it did, he raised the rifle and cocked the hammer, pulling it back as quietly as he could, the sear dropping in with a soft snick. The rifle had two triggers, a set trigger that armed a second front trigger, and made it so sensitive that a mere brush released the hammer. He moved his finger from the set trigger and laid it next to, but didn't touch the hair trigger. Then he settled the German silver blade of the front sight into the tiny notch of the rear sight and floated the tip of the blade sight until it rested just below the shoulder of the young buck, directly over its heart. A half second, no, a quarter second passed. Samuel could touch the hair trigger now and the hammer would drop. The flint would scrape the metal frizzen, kicking it out of the way and showering sparks down on the powder in the small pan, which would ignite and blow a hot jet of gas into the touch hole on the side of the barrel of the rifle, setting off the charge, propelling the small .40 caliber ball down the bore. Before the buck heard the sound of the rifle, the ball would pass through the heart and out the other side of the deer, killing it. And yet, he did not pull the trigger. He waited. Part of a second, then a full second, and another. The deer turned, saw him standing there. With a convulsive explosion of muscle, it jumped straight into the air. It landed running and disappeared into the trees. The whole time, Samuel had not really been thinking of the deer, but what lay east, of what they called civilization. He eased the hammer of the rifle down to the first notch on the sear, a safety position, and lowered the weapon. Oddly, he wasn't disappointed that he had not taken the deer, though the fresh meat would have been nice roasted over the hearth. He'd killed plenty of deer, sometimes 10 or 15 a day, so many they could not possibly eat all the meat. He often shot them because the deer raided the cornfields and had to be killed to save the crops. Most families did not like deer meat anyway. They considered it stringy and tough, and it was often wormy. The preferred meat was bear or beaver, which were richer and less cordy. This deer would have been nice, They had not had fresh meat in nearly 2 weeks, but it was gone now. He could not stop his wondering about what lay to the east, the world. It was supposed to be a better place than the frontier, with a more sensible way to live. And yet he had just learned an ugly truth about that world only the evening before. Those people in the world who are supposed to be civilized, full of knowledge and wisdom and graciousness and wealth and education, were caught in the madness of a vicious, bloody war. It did not make any sense. Samuel started trotting back toward the cabin in an easy shuffle walk that moved him quietly and at some speed without wearing out his moccasins. He was lucky to get a month per pair before they wore through at the heels. He moved without a great deal of effort, his eyes and ears missing very little, as he almost flowed through the forest. But his mind was still on the man who had brought the sheet of paper the night before. Communication. In the year 1776, the fastest form of travel for any distance over 30 or 40 miles was by ship. With steady wind, a sailing vessel could clock 1 to 200 miles a day for weeks on end. A horse could cover 30, maybe even 40 miles a day, although not for an extended period without breaking down. At best, coaches could do 100 miles in a 24-hour day by changing horses every 10 or 15 miles, but only if the roads were in good shape, which they almost never were. A man could walk 20 or 30 miles a day, faster for short periods, but always depending on conditions of land, weather, and footgear. 15 miles a day was standard. So there was no fast and dependable way to transmit information in those years. No telegraph, no telephone, no internet, no texting, no overnight delivery services. It might take 5 or 6 days for knowledge of an important event to move just 10 miles, carried by a traveler on foot. Settlements were 12 to 15 miles apart, and information was carried by hand from person to person on paper, or, in most cases, shared by word of mouth. Chapter 2. Samuel had returned home from the forest the night before and found his parents sipping tea with Isaac, an old man of the forest who stopped by their cabin every few months while he was hunting. This time, though, he had news. He carried information about a fight in Lexington and Concord, Massachusetts, where militia had fired on and defeated British soldiers. The battle had happened months before, all the way back in April of 1775. Isaac seemed to be made entirely of scraps of old leather and rags. He was bald and wore a ratty cap with patches of fur that had been worn away. He was tall and thin, and for many years had lived in a cabin some 20 miles to the east. He was so much a part of the forest that even his brief visits with Samuel's family caused him discomfort. He decided to move farther into the frontier when a wagon pulled by oxen came into the clearing near his cabin. The family was traveling westward, looking for a piece of land to farm, and had chosen a spot not far from Isaac's place. The family was, Isaac said, a crowd, and I knew it was time to move on, seeing as how I don't do particular good with crowds of people. As he was taking his leave from the small shack where he had lived, the family had given him the scrap of paper, soft with wear from all the hands it had passed through, so he could share the news with fellow travelers he met on his journey. They told him of other events they had heard of along the way. He tried to remember the details, but admitted that he wasn't much for conversation. Since there was so much noise from the sprats, as it seemed a dozen of them, my thinker fuzzed up like bad powder, and my recollector might not be all it could be. But I think they said there was another fight at a place called Bunker Hill, and the Patriot militia got whipped there and sent running when they saw the bayonets on the British soldiers' muskets. He sat quietly sipping the evergreen tea he always carried, a brew made from pine and spruce needles. He swore it cured colds, and he said he preferred it over Ferner tea from outside, but thank ye, missus. The paper he had handed to Samuel's father, Olin, was a single sheet that had been folded and unfolded so many times it was near to falling apart. It had been printed on a crude press with wooden block letters and was smudged and hard to read. But there was a brief description of the fight at Lexington and Concord, and a drawing of figures firing muskets at some other figures that were falling to the ground. As Samuel studied the paper in his father's hands, he thought, "Everything in my world just got bigger." Two other families, the Clarks and the Overtons, pulled up in wagons. Isaac had spoken to them on his way to Samuel's place, and they wanted to hear what Olin had to say about Isaac's news. Samuel looked around the small cabin on the edge of the woods that was suddenly filled with people all talking over each other about the meaning of the battles. It seemed that the strong and sturdy log walls no longer protected his family. The loud, outside world his parents had escaped by moving to the frontier had found them. Samuel was excited and frightened and overwhelmed all at the same time. "What does it mean?" Ebenezer Clark asked Olin. His face was red and round as an apple, because he drank home beer, 3 quarts every morning for breakfast. "It could be local. Just some trouble in Boston," Samuel's father said. "A riot or the like. There's always a chance of rabble-rousing in the cities, and it doesn't seem likely that a group of farmers would try to take on the entire British army." He paused, then added thoughtfully, "England has the most powerful army and navy in the world, and a gaggle of farmers would have to be insane to fight them." "Likely or not," this from Lund Harris, a soft-spoken and careful man whose wife Clara sat nursing an infant. "If it happens, we have to think what it means for us out here on the edge." Nobody spoke. Samuel could hear the crackle of the fire in the fireplace. In the homey, safe cabin, the craziness of the information from the east seemed impossible. There was always some measure of violence on the frontier, marauding savages, drunks, thieves, evildoers, men who operated outside the walls of reason. Harshness was to be expected in the wild. But nothing like this. Nothing that challenged the established order, the very rule of the crown, the civilized life that came from the English way of living. The very idea of fighting the British was too big to understand, too huge to even contemplate. These settlers had always been loyal to the rules of the land, obedient to the laws of the country that ruled them. Ben Overton stood. He was a tall, thin man whose sleeves never seemed to come to his wrists. He said, "Well, I think we should do nothing, but wait and see how the wind blows." And with nods and a few mumbles of affirmation, the rest got up and went back to their homes. Not a single person in that cabin could have known what was coming. And even if they had seen the future, they would not have been able to imagine the horror. Frontier life. The only thing that came easy to people of the frontier was land. A single family could own hundreds, even thousands of acres simply by claiming them. If getting the land was easily accomplished, using the land was a different matter. It had to be cleared of trees for farming. Some oaks were 5 or 6 feet in diameter. Each had to be chopped down by axe, cut into manageable sections, and hauled off. Then the stump was dug out of the ground, often with a handmade wooden shovel. One stump might take a week or two of hard work, and a piece of land could have tens of dozens of trees. If a family was lucky, they might find a clearing left by beavers, which log off an area and dam a creek to make a lake, rotting out all the stumps. When the trees and the food are gone, the beavers leave, the dam breaks down, the water drains off, and there is a handy clearing left where the lake was. Chapter 3. The woods were never completely quiet. Even in silence there would be a whisper, a soft change that told something. If you listened, complete quiet could speak worlds. Samuel had gone 5 ridges away from home, hunting, feeling the woods. Something was off. If not wrong, then different. The woods felt strange, as if something had changed or was about to change. Samuel shrugged off the feeling and kept going. It was hard to measure distance, because the ridges varied in height and width, and the forest canopy blocked out the sun. He was hunting bear, so he moved slowly and followed the aimless game trails, looking for signs of life. 5 ridges, going in a straight line, might have meant 4 or 5 miles. The wandering path he followed probably covered more like 7 or 8. He had seen no fresh sign until he came halfway up the 5th ridge, a thickly forested round hump shaped like the back of a giant animal. Then he saw fresh bear droppings, still steaming, filled with berry seeds and grass stems. And he slowed his pace through the thick undergrowth until he came to the top of the ridge. To his surprise, the trees were gone, and he could see miles in all directions. He had hunted this direction many times, but had never reached this ridge before. The thick undergrowth in the summer and early fall had kept him from seeing this high point. He was amazed to find that below him on the western side of the ridge lay a small valley perhaps 1/2 mile long and 1/4 mile wide. The graceful chain of round meadows and lush grass was already perfect farmland. The treeless patch just needed rail fencing and a cabin to be complete. "Perfect," he said aloud, like it was made to be used. A crunching noise to his rear, to the east, brought him around. The bear was 40 or so yards away, a yearling, slope-shouldered, dark brown more than black, like a large dog. It was digging in a rotten stump on the edge of the clearing. Samuel cocked his rifle, raised it, and then held. He looked above the bear across the tops of trees. Smoke. Thick clouds of smoke were rising to the east, almost straight to the east, a goodly distance away. Forest fire? But it wasn't that dry, and there had been no thunderstorms, the normal cause of forest fires. Then he remembered that their neighbor Overton was going to burn limbs and brush from trees he had felled and cleared. The direction and distance looked about right for the settlement. The bear moved, stood, and looked at him. Then dropped and was gone without Samuel's firing. Another missed kill. The smoke was in the right direction and at the probable distance, but there was something wrong with it, the way there had been something wrong with the feel of the woods today. He eased the hammer down on his rifle and lowered the butt to the ground. He stood leaning on it, studying the smoke the way he would read sign from a wounded animal, trying to see the why of it. The gray smudge was wide, not just at the base, but as it rose up, too wide for a single pile of slash. That could be explained by wind blowing the smoke around. But it was a still, clear day. All right, he thought. So Overton set fire to the slash, and it spread into some grass, and that made it wider. But the grass in the settlement area had been grazed to the ground by the livestock, and what was left was still green and hard to burn, and would not make a wide smoke, would not make such a dark, wide smoke that it could be seen from how far? Maybe 8 miles? Smoke that would show that dark and that wide from 8 miles away on a clear, windless day had to be intentional. He frowned, looking at the smoke, willing it to not be what was coming into his mind, like a dark snake, a slithering horror. Some kind of attack. No. He shook his head. No. There had been years of peace, even with a war, a real war, starting back east in the towns and cities. It would not have come out here so soon. It had only been a week since they'd heard the news. It could not come this soon. But even as he thought this, his mind was calculating. Distance home, 8 miles in thick forest. Time until dark, an hour, hour and a half. No moon. It would be hard dark. Could he run 8 miles an hour through the woods in the dark? It would be like running blind. An attack. Had there been an attack on the settlement, on his home? He started running down the side of the ridge. Not a crazy run, but working low and slipping into the game trails, automatically looking for a turn or shift that would take him more directly home. Home. An attack on his home. An attack on his mother and father? And he had not been there to help. Deep breaths, hard, and deep pulls of air as he increased his speed, moccasins slapping the ground, rifle held out in front of him to move limbs out of the way as he loped through the forest. The green thickness that once helped him now seemed to clutch at him, pull him back, hold him. An attack. And he had not been there to protect his parents. Part 2. Red. War, 1776. Weapons. A single rifle, something every frontier family needed, something that was an absolute necessity, might take a year or more and a year's wages to get from one of the rare gunsmiths located perhaps miles away. This was the only weapon many of the rebels carried into battle against the British. The firearm issued to the British Army was called the Brown Bess musket. It was a smooth bore and fired a round ball of 75 caliber, approximately 3/4 inch in diameter, with a black powder charge, ignited by flint, that pushed the ball at 700 or 800 feet per second when it left the muzzle. Modern rifles send the bullet out at just over 3,000 feet per second. Because a round ball fired from a smooth bore is so pitifully inaccurate, the ball bounces off the side of the bore as it progresses down the barrel. The Brown Bess was really only good out to about 50 yards. The ball would vary in flight so widely that it was common for a soldier to aim at one man coming at him and hit another man 4 feet to the left or right. With the Brown Bess, each British soldier was issued a bayonet, nearly 3 feet long, that twist-locked to the end of the barrel and turned the empty weapon into a kind of attacking pike. Along with personal weapons, the British Army employed artillery, small-field cannon, which fired plain round balls, exploding shells and grape shot, scores of round musket balls packed down the bore to make the cannon into something like a giant shotgun. Grape shot was so viciously effective against columns of marching men that its destruction would not be duplicated until the use of the rapid-fire machine gun in the First World War. Whole ranks of attacking men could be torn to pieces in a single shot, the musket ball passing through man after man, ripping them apart. Chapter 4. Samuel smelled it before he saw anything. Not just the smoke from the fires, but the thick, heavy smell. Blood. Death. No. The single word took over his brain. Part of his thinking was automatic, leading him to act with caution, move with stealth. But the front part, the thinking part, hung on one word. No. He'd made good time, running hard until his lungs seemed to be on fire, then jogging until he got his breath, then back to the full-out run. There was probably another half-hour of daylight before it was too dark to see. As he approached the settlement, he slowed and moved off to the side. It would do no good to run head-on if the attackers were still there. He was silent, listening keenly. Surely, if anyone was still there, they would make some noise. All Samuel heard was the crackling of fire, the soft night sounds of evening birds. No human sound. At the edge of the clearing near his home, he paused, frightened, no, terrified at what he would find. He was hidden in some branches, and he studied the area through the leaves to make sure it was clear before he stepped out. The cabin was gone, burned to the ground, side shed and all. Here and there an ember flickered and crackled, and smoke rose into the evening sky, but the building was no more. In the distance he could see that the other cabins, scattered through the clearing, had been burned as well. Dreading what he might find, he forced himself to search the ashes, looking for the slightest indication of bodies. He could not bring himself to think about what he was really looking for. His parents. His brain would not allow it, though he knew the death smell came from someone. He could not allow himself to believe it was from them, from mother and father. He found nothing in the ashes, and when he spread the search out around the cabin, moving in greater circles, he still found no trace that might have been his parents. But as the search loop widened, he began to come across bodies, his neighbors, shot down and hacked where they'd fallen. They did not look like they had been people. What he found seemed more like trash, paper, and cloth blown across the ground. But they were people, friends, and families he had known. A frantic need took him, the thought that the next body might be the one he dreaded most to find. And he ran from one to another, trying to identify them in the failing light. Most had been mutilated so badly it was hard to tell who they'd once been. Overton lay by his cabin, his shirt sleeves still not down on his wrists, chest and stomach filled with arrows, his scalp gone, so his face drooped without the top skin to hold it up. Samuel ran from body to body in the gathering twilight, until at last there were no more bodies to find. No matter how fast he ran, how wide he ran, he did not find his parents. Along with six or seven others, they had not been killed, or at least not been killed here. They had been taken away. They had not been killed. He clung to that thought. They had not been killed. He stood, his breathing ragged, sobbing softly. Twice he had thrown up, and the smell and taste mixed with the tears of frustration and grief for his friends, and rage for what had been done to them. He knew that if he lived to be 100, he would never lose the taste, the smell, or the images of what he had seen, the madness of what men could do to other men in savage rage. Dark caught him now. He had circled through the settlement and was back at his own cabin, or where it had been. There was nothing left that would furnish light. All of the candles had melted. But he trapped some of the embers that were still glowing and made a campfire off from the cabin a bit. In its light, he found the woodpile, which, oddly, had not been burned. And at the side of the pile there was a stack of pine pitch knots and roots that his mother had used to start fires. The pitch concentrated in the knots burned with a smoky hot flame that lasted for an hour or more and would work as a torch. Near the garden plot, he found the oak shovel they had used to turn the earth for gardening. The attackers had overlooked it, or left it as useless, because anything of value had been taken or destroyed. There were 9 bodies to be buried before the coyotes, wolves, and bear came. He knew that he would be moving come daylight, tracking, looking for sign, so the burying had to be done tonight. Carrying spare pine knots and the shovel, he went from body to body. He dug a shallow grave next to each one, knowing that it might not be enough to protect them, that scavengers might dig them up, but so pressed for time that he had no choice. He covered each as best he could. 3 were children, and did not take as long, and though it was hard to tell exactly who they were in the dark and with the condition of the bodies, he remembered the children laughing and playing in front of the Olafsons' cabin, 2 boys and a little girl with a crude doll. He found the doll in the grass and wept as he buried it with the smallest body. He cried over each corpse, thinking of them living, thinking of them meeting in the cabin and living and talking and laughing and just being. And now all gone. Gone. He could not stop crying, thinking of his parents, wondering, worrying. It took 5 hours to bury everyone. It was still dark when he finished and looked around him. Then he realized that he should have said something over the bodies. He did not know the right words, something about ashes and dust, but he took another torch and went back to each grave and bowed his head and said, "Please, Lord, take them with you. Please." It was all he could think to say, and he hoped it was enough. He went back to the campfire by his own cabin site and sat looking into the flames, praying. Praying for safety for his parents and the others who had not been killed. praying for all who survived, but praying most for his parents, and squatting there by the fire, also praying for daylight to come so he could begin looking for them. And in half an hour, a little more, his eyes closed and sleep came and took him down, down, until he was lying on his side by the fire, sleeping deeply with all the bad dreams that he'd known would come, sleeping with twitches and jerks and whimpers at first, and then just sleeping. Sleep. The Americans. The American Army consisted of three parts: the Continental, or regular army, the volunteer militia, including the elite Minutemen, and the Rangers, or small groups that were trained in guerrilla tactics. The Continentals bore the brunt of the fighting, and they were equipped much like the British, with smoothbore brown-bess muskets and sometimes bayonets. Many of them also carried tomahawks, or small hand axes, which could be very effective once past the first line, the line of bayonets. The militia volunteers were usually used to supplement the Continentals, but were quite often not as dependable or steady as they could have been, had they been trained better. And they often evaporated after receiving the first volley and before the bayonets came. Most of them were also issued smoothbore muskets, and some had bayonets for them. But others had rifles, which were very effective at long range, but could not mount bayonets. Special ranger groups, such as Morgan's Rifles, had an effect far past their numbers because of the rifles they carried. A rifle, by definition, has a series of spiral grooves down the inside of the barrel. With the low pressure of black powder, the rifling then was with a slow twist, grooved with a turn of about one rotation for 35 or 40 inches. A patched ball was gripped tightly in the bore and the grooved rifling, and the long bore, up to 40 inches, enabled a larger powder charge, which allowed the ball to achieve a much higher velocity, more than twice that of the smooth bores. And the high rate of rotation, or spin, stabilized the ball flight, resulting in greater accuracy. Chapter 5. Samuel was just 13, but he lived on a frontier where, even when things were normal, someone his age was 13 going on 30. Childhood ended when it was possible to help with chores. For a healthy boy or girl, it ended at 8 or 9, possibly 10. Because of his parents' nature, their lack of physical skills, their joy and gentleness, their love of books and music, their almost childlike wonder in knowing all they could about the whole wide world, but not necessarily the world right around them, Samuel had become the provider for his family. As he embraced the forest, his skill at hunting grew. Actually, the forest embraced him, took him in, made him, as the French said, a courier du bois, a woods runner. Soon, he provided meat for nearly the whole settlement, and in turn, the other men and women helped Samuel's parents with their small farm and took over Samuel's chores when he was in the woods. Samuel's knowledge grew until when he heard a twig break. He would know whether it was a deer or bear or squirrel that broke it. He could look at a track and know when the animal or man made it, and whether or not the creature was in a hurry, and if so, why and how fast it was going, and what, if anything, was chasing it, and how close the pursuer might be. And the more he was of the woods, of the wild, of the green, the less he was of the people. He sometimes enjoyed being with others, and of course he loved his parents. But his skills and his woods knowledge set him apart, made him different. His neighbors in the settlement saw this, and they sought him out when they had a question about the forest or about game. They marveled at him, thought of him as a kind of seer, one who could know more than others, divine things in a spiritual way. Samuel knew this was not the case. He had just learned to see what others could not. Now he brought to the fore all his knowledge to read sign as he met the day. He was on his feet before the first light broke through the trees. He woke desperately thirsty and went to the creek that trickled past the rear of the cabin, and he drank long and hard. The water was so cold it hurt his teeth, and so sweet it took some of the taste stink from the evening before out of his mouth. He was hungry, but he could find no food that the marauders had overlooked. He would have to shoot something along the way. For now, there was nothing to do but read sign and try to figure out what had happened, how it had happened, and exactly when. He started by circling the cabin, forcing himself to take time to be calm, carefully studying the ground, looking closely at the soft dirt away from the grass. First, he found small tracks from moccasins he had made for his mother. Then he saw his father's prints, also from moccasins. The right foot toed in slightly from a time when, showing off as a small boy, he'd broken his ankle jumping from a shed roof. Both sets of prints were in the soft dirt in front of the door of the cabin, in the normal patterns they would make going in and out. Then, in the dirt at the side of the cabin, more moccasin prints, larger, flatter feet, digging deeper, running, as the attackers came. And still more prints, too many to tell them apart. On top of those, which meant they had come later, hard shoes with leather soles and heels. At least three men with regular shoes, two of normal weight and one heavier. On top of all the marks, Samuel saw horse prints, two, maybe three horses, all unshod and being led, because there was no extra weight on them. No men in the settlement wore shoes or could afford horses to ride. Only one man had a single workhorse. Others who could afford animals had oxen, because when they became too old or broken to work, they could be eaten. The attack had been fast. They had come up along the creek. Samuel backtracked and found their prints in the soft soil there, and exploded out in the clearing by the cabin. His parents were probably outside and must have been overrun with no time to react. His father wouldn't have had his musket close anyway. It was like him to leave it inside when working near the house. Samuel's father had seen bad things happen to other people, but he was too good inside, too generous, to believe that they could happen to him. He must believe now, Samuel thought. The attack widened rapidly. He saw where Overton and others had fallen, saw the blood, now covered with flies, where they had been hacked to the ground with tomahawks. It was a mystery to Samuel, though, why his parents had not been killed. He was grateful, but it didn't make any sense. He lost their tracks as he followed the spreading attack. Larger moccasin prints and the shoe prints of the three men were everywhere. He could imagine the terror of the people in the settlement, the war cries of the attackers mixed with screams of the victims and the smell of blood and fear and death. He saw where at least two of the men in shoes had mounted their horses. Here and there he found single or double tracks of his mother and father as they were jerked or pulled, the tracks scuffed and misshapen. New tracks joined theirs as other people were also spared, all of them dragged or pushed toward the eastern side of the settlement. Finally, he saw how it ended. The last of the cabins were burned, the surviving victims, probably necktied to each other with rope, lined up and pulled along the trail. The horses were in front, and the attackers split, some in front, some in back. There was no indication that any prisoners had been wounded or killed. When? When had it happened? He started following the tracks, which a blind man could have followed, and let his mind work on that question. He'd left home early the day before, moving west until he came to new country, since he'd hunted out the forest around the settlement. Say by mid-morning he was out of earshot of gunfire, if anybody had used a gun. All the victims he'd buried had been chopped down with either tomahawks or war clubs. So, the attack could have come mid-morning. That would have been the soonest. If that was the case, then they were just under 24 hours ahead of him. Maybe 20, 22. Moving slowly, as they would with prisoners, they might make 2 miles an hour. With a rest of perhaps 6 hours, they might have traveled 14 to 16 hours, 24 to 28 miles. He shook his head. probably less. He studied the trail ahead and the spacing of the footprints, trying to estimate their speed. They were close together. Even the horses' tracks showed they were moving slowly. 20 miles at the most, yet still on a guess. But he turned out to be wrong. Later he discovered that he'd forgotten that there was another settlement of 4 cabins 10 miles farther on. And the attackers had taken the time to stop and slaughter the people who lived there. The British. Generally poorly trained, the British enlisted soldier was also poorly paid, often going months with no pay at all. Poorly cared for, the wounded were virtually ignored and allowed to die alone, unless a friend had time to help. Poorly fed, salt beef, dried peas, and tea were mainstays. And poorly treated, tied to a wagon wheel and flogged until his back was shredded for the slightest infraction. And yet, somehow, amazingly, up until the War of Independence, he managed to conquer most of the world. Young British officers in England, when they were being shipped out to fight in the colonies, were told to settle your affairs and make out a proper will, because the riflemen will almost certainly kill you. Chapter 6. As he walked, Samuel felt as if he were following some kind of a killing storm. Even the tracks seemed savage. From the footprints, it was evident that the prisoners, tied together, were constantly jerked and pulled to increase their speed. Their prints were scuffed, ragged, and he felt his mother's anguish terribly. She was small and thin and very strong in her own way, but this brutal treatment, probably with a rope around her neck, might be too much for her. If she was too slow, they might... He could not finish the thought. The shock Samuel had felt since he came upon the devastation in the settlement and dealt with the bodies had left him numb. Now it turned to anger, coming into rage, and that was worse because he had to remain calm. He had no idea what to do except to follow his parents' tracks. He saw their footprints now and then. He had to follow and rescue them. How he could do that, free his parents, he'd have to wait and see. Wait until he knew more. He would learn by studying sign. He could not forget himself and his skills now. The people who were leaving the tracks were the people he had to deal with. He had to understand them by the time he caught up with them. He stopped and tried to slow his harsh breathing, tried to still his mind and remember all he had taught himself about studying trails and the surrounding ground. It seemed that all of the captors and captives were walking on the trail, but there might be others off to the side. Quickly, he started to swing to the left and right of the trail. It was mostly grass and hard to read, but at last he saw scuff marks and some moccasin tracks in open dirt. They had scouts on each side of the main group. On the second swing, he found the first body. It was a man in his 30s who'd been picking berries when they'd come upon him. He must have had a rifle or musket. No one would be out in the woods without some kind of weapon, but it was gone, along with his powder horn and possibles bag. He had been scalped, mutilated. Sadly, there was no time for Samuel to give him a decent grave. He scraped a slight trench with his knife and covered the body with a minimum of dirt. He bowed his head, then went back to the trail. Covering the body hadn't taken much time, but it upset him. As he walked on, he tried to still the shaking of his hands. He picked up his speed and came into the clearing of the next settlement before he was ready for it. He thought he knew what he would find. It was just the few cabins, but unlike Samuel's home, it had a name, Draper's Crossing. And it was gone. At first it seemed the same devastation he had found at home, smoke rising from burned cabins and sheds, but when he stopped, he saw that he wasn't alone. On the southern side of the clearing there was a figure. It was an old man. As Samuel approached, he saw that the man was spading dirt with a wooden shovel onto a mound that was clearly a grave. and he was singing. Rock of ages, cleft for me, let me hide myself in thee. Samuel stopped 10 yards away. He saw no weapon, but he stood ready, rifle held across his chest, thumb on the hammer. As the old man patted the dirt with the shovel, Samuel could see 4 other grave mounds where the cabins had been. The man said in a sing-song voice, "There to sleepy, little darling, there to sleepy with the Jesus boy. All to sleepy, little darling, all to sleepy with the Jesus boy." Samuel coughed, but the old man did not turn. "Jesus came. The Jesus boy came and took them all up to heaven." How long ago were they here? Samuel finally interrupted the man's song. The man turned toward Samuel and kept up his singing. "Lordy, then the Jesus boy came and took them all to heaven. There was Draper and Molly, and they came in and took them all to the Jesus boy." How long ago? Can you tell me when they were here? "In the dark they came, took them all to the Jesus boy, took them all, but not old Bobby, no, sir. Didn't take old Bobby, 'cause old Bobby, he sat eating dirt and pointing up at the Jesus boy and talking through his ear holes, and they thinking old Bobby was tetched. But it wasn't so. Water. Is there water or food here? Wasn't touched at all. Just knew how the Jesus boy could save us. So I sat there eating dirt and laughing and praying. With piercing, intense, and otherworldly green eyes, he stared, but not at Samuel. He looked through Samuel at some far place that only he could see, only he could know. He picked up the shovel and started walking off to the south, where Samuel could see 1 more burned cabin. Beside it lay what looked like a pile of rags, but Samuel knew it wasn't. 1 more body. Now he remembered something he'd heard about the Indians. Considering that he had lived his whole life on the frontier, he knew very little about them. And what he did know, he had learned by listening to adults, to rumors and stories they sometimes told after they'd had a little too much hard cider or blackstrap rum. He remembered that some tribes saw crazy people as graced by the higher power, and that they believed that old people who did not think straight should be protected, or at least not harmed. Which must be why they had let old Bobby go. "Maybe he is crazy," Samuel said aloud, watching him walk away with the shovel. "And maybe not. Either way, he's alive." He turned back to the trail. If old Bobby was right, they had come in the dark, probably just before dawn, if they had stopped to rest at all. That meant Samuel was gaining. And that meant he had to keep moving. The world. The war for independence very rapidly turned into something like a world war. Native Americans fought on both sides, and Spain got involved on the American side, or at least its navy did. Germany sent the mercenaries known as Hessians. The French were a staunch ally of the United States, with their navy keeping England from resupplying her troops and distracting it from the American navy. The English navy, in fact, was so preoccupied with the French that it could not focus on the American problem. Chapter 7. He had been running for 40 hours now. Just as he left Draper's Crossing, he passed a cornfield that the attackers had tried to burn. Some ears of corn had been roasted. Hunger took him like a wolf, and he grabbed a half dozen ears, jamming them in his clothing. He ate as he walked, letting the sweet corn juice slide down his throat and into his stomach. The hunger was so intense that eating the corn made his jaws ache. The food made his body demand water. He hadn't taken time to find a well or where one was. When he came to a small creek, he stopped to drink. The water was muddy where the creek crossed the trail, so he moved off into the thick underbrush 20 yards upstream to where the creek ran clear. He knelt to put his mouth to the water, and this act saved